Books on Tape presents World Without End by Ken Follett, read by John Lee. Part 1. 1st November, 1327. Chapter 1. Gwenda was 8 years old, but she was not afraid of the dark. When she opened her eyes, she could see nothing. But that was not what scared her. She knew where she was. She was at Kingsbridge Priory, in the long stone building they called the hospital, lying on the floor in a bed of straw. Her mother lay next to her, and Gwenda could tell, by the warm, milky smell, that Ma was feeding the new baby, who did not yet have a name. Beside Ma was Pa, and next to him, Gwenda's older brother, Philemon, who was 12. The hospital was crowded, and though she could not see the other families lying along the floor, squashed together like sheep in a pen, she could smell the rank odor of their warm bodies. When dawn broke, it would be All Hallows, a Sunday this year, and therefore a specially holy day. By the same token, the night before was All Hallows' Eve, a dangerous time when evil spirits roamed freely. Hundreds of people had come to Kingsbridge from the surrounding villages, as Gwenda's family had, to spend Halloween in the sanctified precincts of the priory, and to attend the All Hallows service at daybreak. Gwenda was wary of evil spirits, like every sensible person, but she was more scared of what she had to do during the service. She stared into the gloom, trying not to think about what frightened her. She knew that the wall opposite her had an arched window. There was no glass, only the most important buildings had glass windows, but a linen blind kept out the cold autumn air. However, she could not even see a faint patch of grey where the window should be. She was glad. She did not want the morning to come. She could see nothing, but there was plenty to listen to. The straw that covered the floor whispered constantly as people stirred and shifted in their sleep. A child cried out, as if woken by a dream, and was quickly silenced by a murmured endearment. Now and again someone spoke, uttering the half-formed words of sleep talk. Somewhere there was the sound of two people doing the thing parents did but never spoke of, the thing Gwenda called grunting, because she had no other word for it. Too soon, there was a light. At the eastern end of the long room behind the altar, a monk came through the door carrying a single candle. He put the candle down on the altar, lit a taper from it, and went around touching the flame to the wall lamps, his long shadow reaching up the wall each time like a reflection, his taper meeting the shadow taper at the wick of the lamp. The strengthening light illuminated rows of humped figures on the floor, wrapped in their drab cloaks or huddled up to their neighbors for warmth. Sick people occupied the cots near the altar, where they could get the maximum benefit from the holiness of the place. At the opposite end, a staircase led to the upper floor, where there were rooms for aristocratic visitors. The Earl of Shiring was there now with some of his family. The monk leaned over Gwenda to light the lamp above her head. He caught her eye and smiled. She studied his face in the shifting light of the flame and recognized him as Brother Godwin. He was young and handsome, and last night he had spoken kindly to Philemon. Beside Gwenda was another family from her village, Samuel, a prosperous peasant with a large landholding, and his wife and two sons, the youngest of whom, Wulfric, was an annoying 6-year-old who thought that throwing acorns at girls then running away was the funniest thing in the world. Gwenda's family was not prosperous. Her father had no land at all, and hired himself out as a laborer to anyone who would pay him. There was always work in the summer, but after the harvest was gathered in and the weather began to turn cold, the family often went hungry. That was why Gwenda had to steal. She imagined being caught, a strong hand grabbing her arm, holding her in an unbreakable grip while she wriggled helplessly, a deep, cruel voice saying, "Well, well, a little thief," the pain and humiliation of a whipping, and then, worst of all, the agony and loss as her hand was chopped off. Her father had suffered this punishment. At the end of his left arm was a hideous, wrinkled stump. He managed well with one hand. He could use a shovel, saddle a horse, and even make a net to catch birds. But all the same, he was always the last labourer to be hired in the spring, and the first to be laid off in the autumn. He could never leave the village and seek work elsewhere, because the amputation marked him as a thief, so that people would refuse to hire him. When travelling, he tied a stuffed glove to the stump, to avoid being shunned by every stranger he met, but that did not fool people for long. Gwenda had not witnessed Pa's punishment. It had happened before she was born, but she had often imagined it, and now she could not help thinking about the same thing happening to her. In her mind, she saw the blade of the axe coming down on her wrist, slicing through her skin and her bones and severing her hand from her arm, so that it could never be reattached, and she had to clamp her teeth together to keep from screaming out loud. People were standing up, stretching and yawning and rubbing their faces. Gwenda got up and shook out her clothes. All her garments had previously belonged to her older brother. She wore a woolen shift that came down to her knees and a tunic over it, gathered at the waist with a belt made of hemp cord. Her shoes had once been laced, but the eyelets were torn and the laces gone, and she tied them to her feet with plaited straw. When she had tucked her hair into a cap made of squirrel tails, she had finished dressing. She caught her father's eye, and he pointed surreptitiously to a family across the way, a couple in middle age with two sons a little older than Gwenda. The man was short and slight, with a curly red beard. He was buckling on a sword, which meant he was a man-at-arms or a knight. Ordinary people were not allowed to wear swords. His wife was a thin woman with a brisk manner and a grumpy face. As Gwenda scrutinized them, Brother Godwin nodded respectfully and said, "Good morning, Sir Gerald, Lady Maud." Gwenda saw what had attracted her father's notice. Sir Gerald had a purse attached to his belt by a leather thong. The purse bulged. It looked as if it contained several hundred of the small, thin silver pennies, halfpennies, and farthings that were the English currency, as much money as Pa could earn in a year if he had been able to find employment. It would be more than enough to feed the family until the spring ploughing. The purse might even contain a few foreign gold coins, florins from Florence or ducats from Venice. Gwenda had a small knife in a wooden sheath, hanging from a cord around her neck. The sharp blade would quickly cut the thong and cause the fat purse to fall into her small hand, unless Sir Gerald felt something strange and grabbed her before she could do the deed. Godwin raised his voice over the rumble of talk. "For the love of Christ, who teaches us charity, breakfast will be provided after the All Hallows service," he said. "Meanwhile, there is pure drinking water in the courtyard fountain. Please remember to use the latrines outside. No pissing indoors." The monks and nuns were strict about cleanliness. Last night, Godwin had caught a 6-year-old boy peeing in a corner and had expelled the whole family. Unless they had a penny for a tavern, they would have had to spend the cold October night shivering on the stone floor of the cathedral's north porch. There was also a ban on animals. Gwenda's 3-legged dog, Hop, had been banished. She wondered where he had spent the night. When all the lamps were lit, Godwin opened the big wooden door to the outside. The night air bit sharply at Gwenda's ears and the tip of her nose. The overnight guests pulled their coats around them and began to shuffle out. When Sir Gerald and his family moved off, Pa and Ma fell into line behind them, and Gwenda and Philemon followed suit. Philemon had done the stealing until now, but yesterday he had almost been caught at Kingsbridge Market. He had palmed a small jar of expensive oil from the booth of an Italian merchant, then he had dropped the jar so that everyone saw it. Mercifully, it had not broken when it hit the ground. He had been forced to pretend that he had accidentally knocked it off the stall. Until recently, Philemon had been small and unobtrusive, like Gwenda, but in the last year he had grown several inches, developed a deep voice, and had become awkward and clumsy, as if he could not get used to his new, larger body. Last night, after the incident with the jar of oil, Pa had announced that Philemon was now too big for serious thieving, and henceforth it was Gwenda's job. That was why she had lain awake for so much of the night. Philemon's name was really Holger. When he was 10 years old, he had decided he was going to be a monk, so he told everyone he had changed his name to Philemon, which sounded more religious. Surprisingly, most people had gone along with his wish, though Ma and Pa still called him Holger. They passed through the door and saw two lines of shivering nuns holding burning torches to light the pathway from the hospital to the great west door of Kingsbridge Cathedral. Shadows flickered at the edges of the torchlight, as if the imps and hobgoblins of the night were cavorting just out of sight, kept at a distance only by the sanctity of the nuns. Gwenda half expected to see Hop waiting outside, but he was not there. Perhaps he had found somewhere warm to sleep. As they walked to the church, Pa made sure they stayed close to Sir Gerald. From behind, someone tugged painfully at Gwenda's hair. She squealed, thinking it was a goblin. But when she turned, she saw Wulfric, her 6-year-old neighbor. He darted out of her reach, laughing. Then his father growled, "Behave!" and smacked his head, and the little boy began to cry. The vast church was a shapeless mass towering above the huddled crowd. Only the lowest parts were distinct, arches and mullions picked out in orange and red by the uncertain torchlight. The procession slowed as it approached the cathedral entrance, and Gwenda could see a group of townspeople coming from the opposite direction. There were hundreds of them, Gwenda thought, maybe thousands, although she was not sure how many people made 1,000, for she could not count that high. The crowd inched through the vestibule. The restless light of the torches fell on the sculpted figures around the walls, making them dance madly. At the lowest level were demons and monsters. Gwenda stared uneasily at dragons and griffins, a bear with a man's head, a dog with 2 bodies and 1 muzzle. Some of the demons struggled with humans. A devil put a noose around a man's neck. A fox-like monster dragged a woman by her hair. An eagle with hands speared a naked man. Above these scenes, the saints stood in a row under sheltering canopies. Over them the apostles sat on thrones. Then in the arch over the main door, St. Peter with his key, and St. Paul with a scroll looked adoringly upward at Jesus Christ. Gwenda knew that Jesus was telling her not to sin, or she would be tortured by demons. But humans frightened her more than demons. If she failed to steal Sir Gerald's purse, she would be whipped by her father. Worse, there would be nothing for the family to eat but soup made with acorns. She and Philemon would be hungry for weeks on end. Ma's breasts would dry up and the new baby would die, as the last two had. Pa would disappear for days and come back with nothing for the pot but a scrawny heron or a couple of squirrels. Being hungry was worse than being whipped. It hurt longer. She had been taught to pilfer at a young age, an apple from a stall, a new-laid egg from under a neighbor's hen, a knife dropped carelessly on a tavern table by a drunk. But stealing money was different. If she were caught robbing Sir Gerald, it would be no use bursting into tears and hoping to be treated as a naughty child, as she had once after thieving a pair of dainty leather shoes from a soft-hearted nun. Cutting the strings of a knight's purse was no childish peccadillo. It was a real grown-up crime, and she would be treated accordingly. She tried not to think about it. She was small and nimble and quick, and she would take the purse stealthily, like a ghost, provided she could keep from trembling. The wide church was already thronged with people. In the side aisles, hooded monks held torches that cast a restless red glow. The marching pillars of the nave reached up into darkness. Gwenda stayed close to Sir Gerald as the crowd pushed forward towards the altar. The red-bearded knight and his thin wife did not notice her. Their 2 boys paid no more attention to her than to the stone walls of the cathedral. Gwenda's family fell back, and she lost sight of them. The nave filled up quickly. Gwenda had never seen so many people in one place. It was busier than the cathedral green on market day. People greeted one another cheerfully, feeling safe from evil spirits in this holy place, and the sound of all their conversations mounted to a roar. Then the bell tolled, and they fell silent. Sir Gerald was standing by a family from the town. They all wore cloaks of fine cloth, so they were probably rich wool dealers. Next to the knight stood a girl about 10 years old. Gwenda stood behind Sir Gerald and the girl. She tried to make herself inconspicuous, but, to her dismay, the girl looked at her and smiled reassuringly, as if to tell her not to be frightened. Around the edges of the crowd the monks extinguished their torches one by one, until the great church was in utter darkness. Gwenda wondered if the rich girl would remember her later. She had not merely glanced at Gwenda, then ignored her, as most people did. She had noticed her, had thought about her, had anticipated that she might be scared, and had given her a friendly smile. But there were hundreds of children in the cathedral. She could not have got a very clear impression of Gwenda's features in the dim light. Could she? Gwenda tried to put the worry out of her mind. Invisible in the darkness, she stepped forward and slipped noiselessly between the two figures, feeling the soft wool of the girl's cloak on one side and the stiffer fabric of the knight's old surcoat on the other. Now she was in a position to get at the purse. She reached into her neckline and took the little knife from its sheath. The silence was broken by a terrible scream. Gwenda had been expecting it. Ma had explained what was going to happen during the service, but all the same she was shocked. It sounded like someone being tortured. Then there was a harsh drumming sound, as of someone beating on a metal plate. More noises followed. Wailing, mad laughter, a hunting horn, a rattle, animal noises, a cracked bell. In the congregation a child started to cry, and others joined in. Some of the adults laughed nervously. They knew the noises were made by the monks, but all the same it was a hellish cacophony. This was not the moment to take the purse, Gwenda thought fearfully. Everyone was tense, alert. The knight would be sensitive to any touch. The devilish noise grew louder. Then a new sound intervened. Music. At first it was so soft that Gwenda was not sure she had really heard it. Then gradually it grew louder. The nuns were singing. Gwenda felt her body flood with tension. The moment was approaching. Moving like a spirit, imperceptible as the air, she turned so that she was facing Sir Gerald. She knew exactly what he was wearing. He had on a heavy wool robe gathered at the waist by a broad studded belt. His purse was tied to the belt with a leather thong. Over the robe he wore an embroidered surcoat, costly but worn, with yellowing bone buttons down the front. He had done up some of the buttons, but not all, probably out of sleepy laziness, or because the walk from the hospital to the church was so short. With a touch as light as possible, Gwenda put one small hand on his coat. She imagined her hand was a spider, so weightless that he could not possibly feel it. She ran her spider hand across the front of his coat and found the opening. She slipped her hand under the edge of the coat and along his heavy belt until she came to the purse. The pandemonium faded as the music grew louder. From the front of the congregation came a murmur of awe. Gwenda could see nothing, but she knew that a lamp had been lit on the altar, illuminating a reliquary, an elaborately carved ivory and gold box holding the bones of St. Adolphus that had not been there when the lights went out. The crowd surged forward, everyone trying to get closer to the holy remains. As Gwenda felt herself squashed between Sir Gerald and the man in front of him, she brought up her right hand and put the edge of the knife to the thong of his purse. The leather was tough, and her first stroke did not cut it. She sawed frantically with the knife, hoping desperately that Sir Gerald was too interested in the scene at the altar to notice what was happening under his nose. She glanced upwards and realized she could just about see the outlines of people around her. The monks and nuns were lighting candles. The light would get brighter every moment. She had no time left. She gave a fierce yank on the knife and felt the thong give. Sir Gerald grunted quietly. Had he felt something, or was he reacting to the spectacle at the altar? The purse dropped and landed in her hand, but it was too big for her to grasp easily, and it slipped. For a terrifying moment, she thought she was going to drop it and lose it on the floor among the heedless feet of the crowd. Then she got a grip on it and held it. She felt a moment of joyous relief she had the purse. But she was still in terrible danger. Her heart was beating so loudly she felt as if everyone must be able to hear it. She turned quickly so that her back was to the knight. In the same movement, she stuffed the heavy purse down the front of her tunic. She could feel that it made a bulge that would be conspicuous, hanging over her belt like an old man's belly. She shifted it around to her side, where it was partly covered by her arm. It would still be visible when the lights brightened, but she had nowhere else to put it. She sheathed the knife. Now she had to get away quickly before Sir Gerald noticed his loss, but the crush of worshippers, which had helped her take the purse unnoticed, now hindered her escape. She tried to step backwards, hoping to force a gap in the bodies behind her, but everyone was still pressing forward to look at the bones of the saint. She was trapped, unable to move, right in front of the man she had robbed. A voice in her ear said, "Are you all right?" It was the rich girl. Gwenda fought down panic. She needed to be invisible. A helpful older child was the last thing she wanted. She said nothing. "Be careful," the girl said to the people around. "You're squashing this little girl." Gwenda could have screamed. The rich girl's thoughtfulness would get Gwenda's hand chopped off. Desperate to get away, she put her hands on the man in front and shoved, pushing herself backwards. She succeeded only in getting the attention of Sir Gerald. "You can't see anything down there, can you?" said her victim in a kindly voice. And, to her horror, he grasped her under the arms and lifted her up. She was helpless. His big hand in her armpit was only an inch from the purse. She faced forward so that he could see only the back of her head, and looked over the crowd to the altar where the monks and nuns were lighting more candles and singing to the long-dead saint. Beyond them, a faint light showed through the big rose window at the east end of the building. Dawn was breaking, chasing the evil spirits away. The clangor had stopped now, and the singing swelled. A tall, good-looking monk stepped up to the altar, and Gwenda recognized him as Antony, the prior of Kingsbridge. Raising his hands in a blessing, he said loudly, "And so, once again, by the grace of Christ Jesus, the evil and darkness of this world are banished by the harmony and light of God's holy church." The congregation gave a triumphant roar, then began to relax. The climax of the ceremony had passed. Gwenda wriggled, and Sir Gerald got the message and put her down. Keeping her face turned away from him, she pushed past him, heading towards the back of the crowd. People were no longer so eager to see the altar, and she was now able to force her way between the bodies. The farther back she went, the easier it became, until at last she found herself by the great west door and saw her family. Pa looked expectantly at her, ready to be angry if she had failed. She pulled the purse out of her shirt and thrust it at him, glad to get rid of it. He grabbed it, turned slightly, and furtively looked inside. She saw him grin with delight. Then he passed the purse to Ma, who quickly shoved it into the folds of the blankets that wrapped the baby. The ordeal was over, but the risk had not yet passed. "A rich girl noticed me," Gwenda said, and she could hear the shrill fear in her own voice. Pa's small dark eyes flashed anger. "Did she see what you did?"
"No, but she told the others not to squash me. Then the knight picked me up so I could see better."
Ma gave a low groan. Pa said,
"He saw your face then?"
"I tried to keep it turned away."
"Still, better if he doesn't come across you again," Pa said.
"We won't return to the monk's hospital. We'll go to a tavern for our breakfast."
Ma said, "We can't hide away all day."
"No, but we can melt into the crowd."
Gwenda started to feel better. Pa seemed to think there was no real danger. Anyway, she was reassured just by his being in charge again and taking the responsibility from her.
"Besides," he went on, "I fancy bread and meat instead of the monk's watery porridge. I can afford it now."
They went out of the church. The sky was pearly grey with dawn light. Gwenda wanted to hold Ma's hand, but the baby started to cry, and Ma was distracted. Then she saw a small three-legged dog, white with a black face,
come running into the cathedral close with a familiar, lopsided stride.
"Hop!"
she cried, and picked him up and hugged him. Chapter 2 Merthin was 11, a year older than his brother Ralph, but to his intense annoyance, Ralph was taller and stronger. This caused trouble with the parents. Their father, Sir Gerald, was a soldier, and could not conceal his disappointment when Merthin proved unable to lift the heavy lance, or became exhausted before the tree was chopped down, or came home crying after losing a fight. Their mother, Lady Maud, made matters worse, embarrassing Merthin by being overprotective, when what he needed her to do was pretend not to notice. When Father showed his pride in Ralph's strength, Mother tried to compensate by criticizing Ralph's stupidity. Ralph was a bit slow on the uptake, but he could not help it, and being nagged about it only made him angry, so that he got into fights with other boys. Both parents were tetchy on the morning of All Hallows' Day. Father had not wanted to come to Kingsbridge at all, but he had been compelled. He owed money to the priory, and he could not pay. Mother said they would take away his lands. He was lord of 3 villages near Kingsbridge. Father reminded her that he was directly descended from the Thomas who became Earl of Shiring in the year that Archbishop Becket was murdered by King Henry II. That Earl Thomas had been the son of Jack Builder, the architect of Kingsbridge Cathedral, and Lady Aliena of Shiring, a near-legendary couple whose story was told on long winter evenings, along with the heroic tales of Charlemagne and Roland. With such ancestry, Sir Gerald could not have his land confiscated by any monk, he bellowed, least of all that old woman Prior Antony. When he started shouting, a look of tired resignation came over Maud's face, and she turned away, though Merthin had heard her mutter, "The Lady Aliena had a brother, Richard, who was no good for anything but fighting." Prior Antony might be an old woman, but he had at least been man enough to complain about Sir Gerald's unpaid debts. He had gone to Gerald's overlord, the present Earl of Shiring, who happened also to be Gerald's second cousin. Earl Roland had summoned Gerald to Kingsbridge today to meet with the prior and work out some resolution, hence Father's bad temper. Then Father was robbed. He discovered the loss after the All Hallows service. Merthin had enjoyed the drama, the darkness, the weird noises, the music beginning so quietly and then swelling until it seemed to fill the huge church, and finally the slow illumination of candles. He had also noticed, as the lights began to come on, that some people had been taking advantage of the darkness to commit minor sins for which they could now be forgiven. He had seen 2 monks hastily stop kissing, and a sly merchant remove his hand from the plump breast of a smiling woman who appeared to be someone else's wife. Merthin was still in an excited mood when they returned to the hospital. As they were waiting for the nuns to serve breakfast, a kitchen boy passed through the room and went up the stairs carrying a tray with a big jug of ale and a platter of hot salt beef. Mother said grumpily, "I would think your relative, the Earl, might invite us to breakfast with him in his private room. After all, your grandmother was sister to his grandfather." Father replied, "If you don't want porridge, we can go to the tavern." Merthin's ears pricked up. He liked tavern breakfasts of new bread and salt butter. But Mother said, "We can't afford it." "We can," Father said, feeling for his purse, and that was when he realized it was gone. At first he looked around the floor, as if it might have fallen. Then he noticed the cut ends of the leather thong, and he roared with indignation. Everyone looked at him except Mother, who turned away, and Merthin heard her mutter, "That was all the money we had." Father glared accusingly at the other guests in the hospital. The long scar that ran from his right temple to his left eye seemed to darken with rage. The room went quiet with tension. An angry knight was dangerous, even one who was evidently down on his luck. Then Mother said, "You were robbed in the church, no doubt." Merton guessed that must be right. In the darkness, people had been stealing more than kisses.
Sacrilege, too, said Father.
I expect it happened when you picked up that little girl, Mother went on. Her face was twisted as if she had swallowed something bitter. The thief probably reached around your waist from behind.
He must be found,
Father roared. The young monk called Godwin spoke up. I'm very sorry this has happened, Sir Gerald, he said. I will go and tell John Constable right away. He can look out for a poor townsman who has suddenly become rich. That seemed to Merthyn a very unpromising plan. There were thousands of townspeople and hundreds more visitors. The constable could not observe them all. But Father was slightly mollified. The rogue shall hang, he said in a voice a little less loud. And meanwhile, perhaps you and Lady Maud and your sons would do us the honour of sitting at the table that is being set up in front of the altar, Godwin said smoothly. Father grunted. He was pleased, Merthyn knew, to be accorded higher status than the mass of guests who would eat sitting on the floor where they had slept. The moment of potential violence passed, and Merthyn relaxed a little. But, as the four of them took their seats, he wondered anxiously what would happen to the family now. His father was a brave soldier, everyone said that. Sir Gerald had fought for the old king at Boroughbridge, where a Lancashire rebel's sword had given him the scar on his forehead. But he was unlucky. Some knights came home from battle with booty, plundered jewels, a cartload of costly Flemish cloth and Italian silk, or the beloved father of a noble family who could be ransomed for £1,000. Sir Gerald never seemed to get much loot, but he still had to buy weapons, armour, and an expensive warhorse to enable him to do his duty and serve the king, and somehow the rents from his lands were never enough. So, against Mother's will, he had started to borrow. The kitchen hands brought in a steaming cauldron. Sir Gerald's family were served first. The porridge was made with barley and flavoured with rosemary and salt. Ralph, who did not understand the family crisis, started to talk excitedly about the All Hallows service, but the glum silence in which his comments were received shut him up. When the porridge was eaten, Merthyn went to the altar. Behind it, he had stashed his bow and arrows. People would hesitate to steal something from an altar. They might overcome their fears if the reward were tempting enough, but a homemade bow was not much of a prize, and sure enough, it was still there. He was proud of it. It was small, of course. To bend a full-size 6-foot bow took all the strength of a grown man. Merthyn's was 4 foot long and slender, but in other respects it was just like the standard English longbow that had killed so many Scots mountain men, Welsh rebels, and French knights in armour. Father had not previously commented on the bow, and now he looked at it as if seeing it for the first time. "Where did you get the stave?" he said. "They're costly." "Not this one. It's too short. A bowyer gave it me." Father nodded. "Apart from that, it's a perfect stave," he said. "It's taken from the inside of the yew, where the sapwood meets the heartwood." He pointed to the two different colours.
"I know,"
Merthyn said eagerly. He did not often get the chance to impress his father. "The stretchy sapwood is best for the front of the bow, because it pulls back to its original shape, and the hard heartwood is best for the inside of the curve, because it pushes back when the bow is bent inwards."
"Exactly," Father said.
He handed the bow back. "But remember, this is not a nobleman's weapon. Knight's sons do not become archers. Give it to some peasant boy." Merthyn was crestfallen.
"I haven't even tried it yet."
Mother intervened.
"Let them play," she said. "They're only boys."
"True," Father said, losing interest. "I wonder if those monks would bring us a jug of ale."
"Off you go," Mother said. "Merthyn, take care of your brother."
Father grunted. "More likely to be the other way around." Merthyn was stung. Father had no idea what went on. Merthyn could look after himself, but Ralph on his own would get into fights. However, Merthyr knew better than to take issue with his father in this mood, and he left the hospital without saying anything. Ralph trailed behind him. It was a clear, cold November day, and the sky was roofed with high, pale grey cloud. They left the cathedral close and walked down the main street, passing Fish Lane, Leather Yard, and Cookshop Street. At the bottom of the hill they crossed the wooden bridge over the river, leaving the old city for the suburb called Newtown. Here the streets of timber houses ran between pastures and gardens. Merthyr led the way to a meadow called Lover's Field. There the town constable and his deputies had set up butts, targets for archery. Shooting practice after church was compulsory for all men by order of the king. Enforcement was not much needed. It was no hardship to loose off a few arrows on a Sunday morning, and 100 or so of the young men of the town were lining up for their turn, watched by women, children, and men who considered themselves too old or too dignified to be archers. Some had their own weapons. For those too poor to afford a bow, John Constable had inexpensive practice bows made of ash or hazel. It was like a feast day. Dick Brewer was selling tankards of ale from a barrel on a cart, and Betty Baxter's four adolescent daughters were walking around with trays of spiced buns for sale. The wealthier townspeople were done up in fur caps and new shoes, and even the poorer women had dressed their hair and trimmed their cloaks with new braid. Merthyr was the only child carrying a bow, and he immediately attracted the attention of other children. They crowded around him and Ralph, the boys asking envious questions, the girls looking admiring or disdainful, according to temperament. One of the girls said, "How did you know how to make it?" Merthyr recognized her. She had stood near him in the cathedral. She was about a year younger than himself, he thought, and she wore a dress and cloak of expensive, close-woven wool. Merthyr usually found girls of his own age tiresome. They giggled a lot and refused to take anything seriously. But this one looked at him and his bow with a frank curiosity that he liked. "I just guessed," he said. "That's clever. Does it work?" "I haven't tried it." "What's your name?" "Caris, from the Wooler family." "Who are you?"
"Merthyr. My father is Sir Gerald."
Merthyr pushed back the hood of his cape, reached inside it, and took out a coiled bowstring.
"Why do you keep the string in your hat?"
"So it won't get wet if there's rain. It's what the real archers do." He attached the twine to the notches at either end of the stave, bending the bow slightly so that the tension would hold the string in place.
"Are you going to shoot at the targets?"
"Yes."
Another boy said, "They won't let you."
Merthyr looked at him. He was about 12, tall and thin with big hands and feet. Merthyr had seen him last night in the Priory Hospital with his family. His name was Philemon. Merthyr had noticed him hanging around the monks, asking questions and helping to serve supper.
"Of course they'll let me," Merthyr told him. "Why shouldn't they?"
"Because you're too young."
"That's stupid."
Even as he spoke, Merthyr knew he should not be so sure. Adults often were stupid. But Philemon's assumption of superior knowledge irritated him, especially after he had shown confidence in front of Caris. He left the children and walked over to a group of men waiting to use a target. He recognized one of them, an exceptionally tall, broad-shouldered man called Mark Webber. Mark noticed the bow and spoke to Merthyr in a slow, amiable voice.
"Where did you get that?"
"I made it," Merthyr said proudly.
"Look at this, Alfric," Mark said to his neighbour. "He's made a nice job of it."
Alfric was a brawny man with a sly look. He gave the bow a cursory glance.
"It's too small," he said dismissively. "That'll never fire an arrow to penetrate a French knight's armour."
"Perhaps not," Mark said mildly. "But I expect the lad's got a year or two to go before he has to fight the French." John Constable called out,
"We're ready. Let's get started. Mark Webber, you're first."
The giant stepped up to the line. He picked up a stout bow and tested it, bending the thick wood effortlessly. The constable noticed Merthyr for the first time.
No, boys, he said.
Why not?
Merthin protested.
Never mind why not. Just get out of the way.
Merthin heard some of the other children snigger.
There's no reason for it, he said indignantly.
I don't have to give reasons to children, John said. All right, Mark, take your shot.
Merthin was mortified. The oily Philemon had proved him wrong in front of everyone. He turned away from the targets.
I told you so, said Philemon.
Oh, shut up and go away.
You can't make me go away, said Philemon, who was 6 inches taller than Merthin.
Ralph put in,
I could, though.
Merthin sighed. Ralph was unfailingly loyal, but he did not see that for him to fight Philemon would only make Merthin look like a weakling as well as a fool.
I'm leaving anyway, said Philemon. I'm going to help Brother Godwin.
He walked off. The other children began to drift away, seeking other curiosities. Carys said to Merthin, You could go somewhere else to try the bow. She was obviously keen to see what would happen. Merthin looked around. But where? If he was seen shooting unsupervised, the bow might be taken from him.
We could go into the forest.
Merthin was surprised. Children were forbidden to go into the forest. Outlaws hid there, men and women who lived by stealing. Children might be stripped of their clothes or made into slaves, and there were worse dangers that parents only hinted at. Even if they escaped such perils, the children were liable to be flogged by their fathers for breaking the rule. But Carys did not seem to be afraid, and Merthin was reluctant to appear less bold than she. Besides, the constable's curt dismissal had made him feel defiant.
All right, he said, but we'll have to make sure no one sees us.
She had the answer to that.
I know a way.
She walked towards the river. Merthin and Ralph followed. A small three-legged dog tagged along.
"What's your dog's name?"
Merthin asked Carys.
"He's not mine," she said, "but I gave him a piece of mouldy bacon, and now I can't shake him off."
They walked along the muddy bank of the river, past warehouses and wharves and barges. Merthin covertly studied this girl who had so effortlessly become the leader. She had a square, determined face, neither pretty nor ugly, and there was mischief in her eyes, which were a greenish colour with brown flecks. Her light brown hair was done in two plaits, as was the fashion among affluent women. Her clothes were costly, but she wore practical leather boots rather than the embroidered fabric shoes preferred by noble ladies. She turned away from the river and led them through a timber yard, and suddenly they were in scrubby woodland. Merthin felt a pang of unease. Now that he was in the forest, where there might be an outlaw lurking behind any oak tree, he regretted his bravado, but he would be ashamed to back out. They walked on, looking for a clearing big enough for archery. Suddenly, Carys spoke in a conspiratorial voice.
You see that big holly bush?
Yes.
As soon as we're past it, crouch down with me and keep silent.
Why? You'll see.
A moment later, Merthin, Ralph, and Carys squatted behind the bush. The three-legged dog sat with them and looked hopefully at Carys. Ralph began to ask a question, but Carys hushed him. A minute later, a little girl came by. Carys jumped out and grabbed her. The girl screamed.
Be quiet!
Carys said. We're not far from the road, and we don't want to be heard.
Why are you following us?
You've got my dog, and he won't come back!
The child sobbed.
I know you. I met you in church this morning,
Carys said to her in a softer voice.
All right. There's nothing to cry about. We aren't going to do you any harm. What's your name?
Gwenda.
And the dog?
Hop.
Gwenda picked up the dog and he licked her tears.
Well, you've got him now. You'd better come with us in case he runs off again. Besides, you might not be able to find your way back to town on your own.
They went on. Merthin said, What has 8 arms and 11 legs?
I'll give up, Ralph said immediately. He always did.
I know, said Carys with a grin. It's us, 4 children and the dog.
She laughed.
That's good.
Merthyn was pleased. People did not always get his jokes. Girls almost never did. A moment later, he heard Gwenda explaining it to Ralph. Two arms and two arms and two arms and two arms makes eight, she said. Two legs. They saw no one, which was good. The small number of people who had legitimate business in the forest, woodcutters, charcoal burners, iron smelters, would not be working today, and it would be unusual to see an aristocratic hunting party on a Sunday. Anyone they met was likely to be an outlaw. But the chances were slim. It was a big forest, stretching for many miles. Merthyn had never travelled far enough to see the end of it. They came to a wide clearing, and Merthyn said, "This will do." There was an oak tree with a wide trunk on the far edge, about 50 feet away. Merthyn stood side on to the target, as he had seen the men do. He took out one of his three arrows and fitted the notched end to the bowstring. The arrows had been as difficult to make as the bow. The wood was ash, and they had goose feather flights. He had not been able to get iron for the points, so he had simply sharpened the ends, then scorched the wood to harden it. He sighted on the tree, then pulled back on the bowstring. It took a great effort. He released the arrow. It fell to the ground well short of the target. Hop the dog scampered across the clearing to fetch it. Merthyn was taken aback. He had expected the arrow to go winging through the air and embed its point in the tree. He realized that he had not bent the bow sufficiently. He tried the bow in his right hand and the arrow in his left. He was unusual in this respect, that he was neither right-handed nor left-handed, but a mixture. With the second arrow, he pulled on the bowstring and pushed the bow with all his might, and succeeded in bending them farther than before. This time, the arrow almost reached the tree. For his third shot, he aimed the bow upwards, hoping the arrow would fly through the air in an arc and come down into the trunk. But he overcompensated, and the arrow went into the branches and fell to the ground amid a flurry of dry brown leaves. Merthyn was embarrassed. Archery was more difficult than he had imagined. The bow was probably all right, he guessed. The problem was his own proficiency, or lack of it. Once again, Caris seemed not to notice his discomfiture.
"Let me have a go," she said.
"Girls can't shoot," Ralph said, and he snatched the bow from Merthyn. Standing sideways on to the target, as Merthyn had, he did not shoot straight away, but flexed the bow several times, getting the feel of it. Like Merthyn, he found it harder than he had at first expected, but after a few moments he seemed to get the hang of it. Hop had dropped all three arrows at Gwenda's feet, and now the little girl picked them up and handed them to Ralph. He took aim without drawing the bow, sighting the arrow at the tree trunk, while there was no pressure on his arms. Merthyn realized he should have done the same. Why did these things come so naturally to Ralph, who could never answer a riddle? Ralph drew the bow, not effortlessly, but with a fluid motion, seeming to take the strain with his thighs. He released the arrow and it hit the trunk of the oak tree, sinking an inch or more into the soft outer wood. Ralph laughed triumphantly. Hop scampered after the arrow. When he reached the tree, he stopped, baffled. Ralph was drawing the bow again. Merthyn realized what he was intending to do.
"Don't!"
he said. But he was a moment too late. Ralph shot at the dog. The arrow hit the back of its neck and sunk in. Hop fell forward and lay twitching. Gwenda screamed. Caris said,
"Oh, no!"
The two girls ran to the dog. Ralph was grinning. "What about that?" he said proudly.
"You shot her dog!"
Merthyn said angrily.
"Doesn't matter. It only had three legs."
"The little girl was fond of it, you idiot.
Look at her crying."
"You're just jealous because you can't shoot." Something caught Ralph's eye. With a smooth movement, he notched another arrow, swept the bow around in an arc, and fired while it was still moving. Merthyn did not see what he was shooting at until the arrow met its target, and a fat hare jumped into the air with the shaft sticking deep into its hindquarters. Merthin could not hide his admiration. Even with practice, not everyone could hit a running hare. Ralph had a natural gift. Merthin was jealous, although he would never admit it. He longed to be a knight, bold and strong, and fight for the king as his father did, and it dismayed him when he turned out to be hopeless at things such as archery. Ralph found a stone and crushed the hare's skull, putting it out of its misery. Merthin knelt beside the two girls and Hop. The dog was not breathing. Caris gently drew the arrow out of its neck and handed it to Merthin. There was no gush of blood. Hop was dead. For a moment no one spoke. In the silence, they heard a man shout. Merthin sprang to his feet, heart thudding. He heard another shout, a different voice. There was more than one person. Both sounded aggressive and angry. Some kind of fight was going on. He was terrified, and so were the others. As they stood frozen, listening, they heard another sound, the noise made by a man running headlong through woodland, snapping fallen branches, flattening saplings, trampling dead leaves. He was coming their way. Caris spoke first. "The bush," she said, pointing to a big cluster of evergreen shrubs, probably the home of the hare Ralph had shot, Merthin thought. A moment later she was flat on her belly, crawling into the thicket. Gwenda followed, cradling the body of Hop. Ralph picked up the dead hare and joined them. Merthin was on his knees when he realized that they had left a telltale arrow sticking out of the tree trunk. He dashed across the clearing, pulled it out, ran back, and dived under the bush. They heard the man breathing before they saw him. He was panting hard as he ran, drawing in ragged lungfuls of air in a way that suggested he was almost done in. The shouts were coming from his pursuers, calling to each other. "This way! Over here!" Merthin recalled that Caris had said they were not far from the road. Was the fleeing man a traveller who had been set upon by thieves? A moment later, he burst into the clearing. He was a knight in his early 20s, with both a sword and a long dagger attached to his belt. He was well-dressed, in a leather travelling tunic and high boots with turned-over tops. He stumbled and fell, rolled over, got up, then stood with his back to the oak tree, gasping for breath, and drew his weapons. Merthin glanced at his playmates. Caris was white with fear, biting her lip. Gwenda was hugging the corpse of her dog as if that made her feel safer. Ralph looked scared, too, but he was not too frightened to pull the arrow out of the hare's rump and stuff the dead animal down the front of his tunic. For a moment, the knight seemed to stare at the bush, and Merthin felt, with terror, that he must have seen the hiding children. Or perhaps he had noticed broken branches and crushed leaves where they had pushed through the foliage. Out of the corner of his eye, Merthin saw Ralph notch an arrow to the bow. Then the pursuers arrived. They were two men-at-arms, strongly built and thuggish-looking, carrying drawn swords. They wore distinctive two-colored tunics, the left side yellow and the right green. One had a surcoat of cheap brown wool, the other a grubby black cloak. All three men paused, catching their breath. Merthin was sure he was about to see the knight hacked to death, and he suffered a shameful impulse to burst into tears. Then, suddenly, the knight reversed his sword and offered it, hilt first, in a gesture of surrender. The older man-at-arms in the black cloak stepped forward and reached out with his left hand. Warily, he took the proffered sword, handed it to his partner, then accepted the knight's dagger. Then he said, "It's not your weapons I want, Thomas Langley. You know me, but I don't know you," said Thomas. If he was feeling any fear, he had it well under control. "By your coats, you must be the Queen's men." The older man put the point of his sword to Thomas's throat and pushed him up against the tree. "You've got a letter. Instructions from the Earl to the Sheriff on the subject of taxes. You're welcome to read it." This was a joke. The men-at-arms were almost certainly unable to read. Thomas had a cool nerve, Merthin thought, to mock men who seemed ready to kill him.
The second man-at-arms reached under the sword of the first and grasped the wallet attached to Thomas's belt. Impatiently, he cut the belt with his sword. He threw the belt aside and opened the wallet. He took out a smaller bag made of what appeared to be oiled wool, and drew from that a sheet of parchment rolled into a scroll and sealed with wax. Could this fight be about nothing more than a letter? Merthyn wondered. If so, what was written on the scroll? It was not likely to be routine instructions about taxes. Some terrible secret must be inscribed there. If you kill me, the knight said, the murder will be witnessed by whoever is hiding in that bush. The tableau froze for a split second. The man in the black cloak kept his sword point pressed to Thomas's throat and resisted the temptation to look over his shoulder. The one in green hesitated, then looked at the bush. At that point, Gwenda screamed. The man in the green surcoat raised his sword and took two long strides across the clearing to the bush. Gwenda stood up and ran, bursting out of the foliage. The man-at-arms leaped after her, reaching out to grab her. Ralph stood up suddenly, raised the bow, and drew it in one fluid motion and shot an arrow at the man. It went through his eye and sank several inches into his head. His left hand came up, as if to grasp the arrow and pull it out. Then he went limp and fell like a dropped sack of grain, hitting the ground with a thump Merthyn could feel. Ralph ran out of the bush and followed Gwenda. At the edge of his vision, Merthyn perceived Carys going after them. Merthyn wanted to flee too, but his feet seemed stuck to the ground. There was a shout from the other side of the clearing, and Merthyn saw that Thomas had knocked aside the sword that threatened him and had drawn, from somewhere about his person, a small knife with a blade as long as a man's hand. But the man-at-arms in the black cloak was alert and jumped back out of reach. Then he raised his sword and swung at the knight's head. Thomas dodged aside, but not fast enough. The edge of the blade came down on his left forearm, slicing through the leather jerkin and sinking into his flesh. He roared with pain, but did not fall. With a quick motion that seemed extraordinarily graceful, he swung his right hand up and thrust the knife into his opponent's throat. Then, his hand continuing in an arc, he pulled the knife sideways, severing most of the neck. Blood came like a fountain from the man's throat. Thomas staggered back, dodging the splash. The man in black fell to the ground, his head hanging from his body by a strip. Thomas dropped the knife from his right hand and clutched his wounded left arm. He sat on the ground, suddenly looking weak. Merthyn was alone with the wounded knight, two dead men-at-arms, and the corpse of a three-legged dog. He knew he should run after the other children, but his curiosity kept him there. Thomas now seemed harmless, he told himself. The knight had sharp eyes. You can come out, he called. I'm no danger to you in this state. Hesitantly, Merthyn got to his feet and pushed his way out of the bush. He crossed the clearing and stopped several feet away from the sitting knight. Thomas said, If they find out, you've been playing in the forest. You'll be flogged. Merthyn nodded. I'll keep your secret, if you'll keep mine. Merthyn nodded again. In agreeing to the bargain, he was making no concessions. None of the children would tell what they had seen. There would be untold trouble if they did. What would happen to Ralph, who had killed one of the Queen's men? Would you be kind enough to help me bind up this wound? Said Thomas. Despite all that had happened, he spoke courteously, Merthyn observed. The knight's poise was remarkable. Merthyn felt he wanted to be like that when he was grown up. At last Merthyn's constricted throat managed to produce a word.
Yes. Pick up that broken belt, then, and wrap it around my arm, if you would.
Merthyn did as he was told. Thomas's undershirt was soaked with blood, and the flesh of his arm was sliced open like something on a butcher's slab. Merthyn felt a little nauseated, but he forced himself to twist the belt around Thomas's arm so that it pulled the wound closed and slowed the bleeding. He made a knot, and Thomas used his right hand to pull it tight. Then Thomas struggled to his feet. He looked at the dead men. We can't bury them, he said.
I'd bleed to death before the graves were dug. Glancing at Merthin, he added, even with you helping me. He thought for a moment. On the other hand, I don't want them to be discovered by some courting couple looking for a place to be alone. Let's lug the guts into that bush where you were hiding. Green coat first. They approached the body. One leg each, said Thomas. With his right hand, he grasped the dead man's left ankle. Merthin took the other limp foot in both hands and heaved. Together they hauled the corpse into the shrubbery, next to Hop. That will do, said Thomas. His face was white with pain. After a moment, he bent down and pulled the arrow out of the corpse's eye. Yours? He said with a raised eyebrow. Merthin took the arrow and wiped it on the ground to get rid of some of the blood and brains adhering to the shaft. In the same way, they dragged the second body across the clearing, its loosely attached head trailing behind, and left it beside the first. Thomas picked up the two men's dropped swords and threw them into the bush with the bodies. Then he found his own weapons. Now, said Thomas, I have a great favor to ask. He proffered his dagger. Would you dig me a small hole? All right. Merthin took the dagger. Just here. Right in front of the oak tree. How big? Thomas picked up the leather wallet that had been attached to his belt. Big enough to hide this for 50 years. Screwing up his courage, Merthin said, Why? Dig, and I'll tell you as much of it as I can. Merthin scratched a square on the ground and began to loosen the cold earth with the dagger, and then scoop it up with his hands. Thomas picked up the scroll and put it into the wool bag, then fastened the bag inside the wallet. I was given this letter to deliver to the Earl of Shiring, he said, but it contains a secret so dangerous that I realized the bearer is sure to be killed, to make certain he can never speak of it. So I needed to disappear. I decided I would take sanctuary in a monastery, become a monk. I've had enough of fighting, and I've a lot of sins to repent. As soon as I went missing, the people who gave me the letter started to search for me, and I was unlucky. I was spotted in a tavern in Bristol. Why did the Queen's men come after you? She, too, would like to prevent the spread of this secret. When Merthin's hole was 18 inches deep, Thomas said, That will do. He dropped the wallet inside. Merthin shoveled the earth back into the hole on top of the wallet, and Thomas covered the freshly turned earth with leaves and twigs until it was indistinguishable from the ground around it. If you hear that I've died, said Thomas, I'd like you to dig up this letter and give it to a priest. Would you do that for me? All right. Until that happens, you must tell no one. While they know I've got the letter, but they don't know where it is, they'll be afraid to do anything. But if you tell the secret, two things will happen. First, they will kill me. Then, they will kill you. Merthin was aghast. It seemed unfair that he should be in so much danger just because he helped a man by digging a hole. I'm sorry to scare you, said Thomas, but then, it's not entirely my fault. After all, I didn't ask you to come here. No. Merthin wished with all his heart that he had obeyed his mother's orders and stayed out of the forest. I'm going to return to the road. Why don't you go back the way you came? I bet you'll find your friends waiting somewhere not far from here. Merthin turned to go. What's your name? The knight called after him. Merthin, son of Sir Gerald. Really? Thomas said, as if he knew father. Well, not a word, even to him. Merthin nodded and left. When he had gone 50 yards, he vomited. After that, he felt slightly better. As Thomas had predicted, the others were waiting for him right at the edge of the wood near the timber yard. They crowded around him, touching him as if to make sure he was all right, looking relieved yet ashamed, as if they were guilty about having left him. They were all shaken, even Ralph. That man, he said, the one I shot, was he badly hurt? He's dead, Merthin said. He showed Ralph the arrow still stained with blood.
Did you pull it out of his eye?
Merthin would have liked to say he had, but he decided to tell the truth. The knight pulled it out. What happened to the other man-at-arms? The knight cut his throat. Then we hid the bodies in the bush.
And he just let you go?
Yes. Merthin said nothing about the buried letter.
We have to keep this secret,
Karis urged. There will be terrible trouble if anyone finds out. Ralph said, I'll never tell.
We should swear an oath, Karis said.
They stood in a little ring. Karis stuck out her arm so that her hand was in the center of the circle. Merthin placed his hand over hers. Her skin was soft and warm. Ralph added his hand, then Gwenda did the same, and they swore by the blood of Jesus. Then they walked back into the town. Archery practice was over, and it was time for the midday meal. As they crossed the bridge, Merthin said to Ralph, When I grow up, I want to be like that knight, always courteous, never frightened, deadly in a fight.
Me too, said Ralph. Deadly.
In the old city, Merthin felt an irrational sense of surprise that normal life was going on all around. The sound of babies crying, the smell of roasting meat, the sight of men drinking ale outside taverns. Karis stopped outside a big house on the main street, just opposite the entrance to the priory precincts. She put an arm around Gwenda's shoulders and said,
My dog at home has had puppies. Do you want to see them?
Gwenda still looked frightened and close to tears, but she nodded emphatically.
Yes, please.
That was clever as well as kind, Merthin thought. The puppies would be a comfort to the little girl, and a distraction, too. When she returned to her family, she would talk about the puppies, and be less likely to speak of going into the forest. They said goodbye, and the girls went into the house. Merthin found himself wondering when he would see Karis again. Then his other troubles came back to him. What was his father going to do about his debts? Merthin and Ralph turned into the cathedral close, Ralph still carrying the bow and the dead hare. The place was quiet. The guest house was empty but for a few sick people. A nun said to them,
Your father is in the church with the Earl of Shiring.
They went into the great cathedral. Their parents were in the vestibule. Mother was sitting at the foot of a pillar, on the out-jutting corner where the round column met the square base. In the cold light that came through the tall windows, her face was still and serene, almost as if she were carved of the same grey stone as the pillar against which she leaned her head. Father stood beside her, his broad shoulders slumped in an attitude of resignation. Earl Roland faced them. He was older than Father, but with his black hair and vigorous manner he seemed more youthful. Prior Anthony stood beside the Earl. The two boys hung back at the door, but Mother beckoned them.
Come here, she said. Earl Roland has helped us come to an arrangement with Prior Anthony that solves all our problems.
Father grunted, as if he was not as grateful as she for what the Earl had done. And the Priory gets my lands, he said. There'll be nothing for you two to inherit.
We're going to live here in Kingsbridge, Mother went on brightly. We'll be Corrodians of the Priory.
Merthin said,
What's a Corrodian?
It means the monks will provide us with a house to live in and two meals a day for the rest of our lives.
Isn't that wonderful?
Merthin could tell that she did not really think it was wonderful. She was pretending to be pleased. Father was clearly ashamed to have lost his lands. There was more than a hint of disgrace in this, Merthin realized. Father addressed the Earl. What about my boys? Earl Roland turned and looked at them.
The big one looks promising, he said. Did you kill that hare, lad?
Yes, Lord, Ralph said proudly. Shot it with an arrow.
He can come to me as a squire in a couple of years' time, the Earl said briskly. We'll teach him to be a knight.
Father looked pleased. Merthin felt bewildered. Big decisions were being made too quickly. He was outraged that his younger brother should be so favored, while no mention was made of himself.
That's not fair, he burst out. I want to be a knight too.
His mother said,
No! But I made the bow.
Father gave a sigh of exasperation and looked disgusted. You made the bow, did you, little one? The Earl said, and his face showed disdain. In that case, you shall be apprenticed to a carpenter.
Chapter 3 Carus's home was a luxurious wood-frame building with stone floors and a stone chimney. There were three separate rooms on the ground floor. The hall with the big dining table, the small parlour where Papa could discuss business privately, and the kitchen at the back. When Carus and Gwenda walked in, the house was full of the mouth-watering smell of a ham boiling. Carus led Gwenda through the hall and up the internal staircase.
"Where are the puppies?" said Gwenda.
"I want to see my mother first," Carus replied. "She's ill."
They went into the front bedroom where Mama lay on the carved wooden bedstead. She was small and frail. Carus was already the same height. Mama looked paler than usual today, and her hair was not yet dressed, so it stuck to her damp cheeks.
"How are you feeling?" Carus said. "A little weak today."
The effort of speaking made Mama breathless. Carus felt a familiar, painful jumble of anxiety and helplessness. Her mother had been ill for a year. It had started with pains in her joints. Soon she had ulcers inside her mouth and unaccountable bruises on her body. She had felt too weak to do anything. Last week she had caught a cold. Now she was running a fever and had trouble in catching her breath.
"Is there anything you need?" Carus asked. "No, thank you."
It was the usual answer, but Carus felt maddened by powerlessness each time she heard it.
"Should I fetch Mother Cecilia?"
The prioress of Kingsbridge was the only person able to bring Mama some comfort. She had an extract of poppies that she mixed with honey and warm wine that eased the pain for a while. Carus regarded Cecilia as better than an angel.
"No need, dear," Mama said. "How was the All Hallows service?"
Carus noticed how pale her mother's lips were.
"Scary," she said.
Mama paused, resting, then said,
"What have you been doing this morning?"
"Watching the archery."
Carus held her breath, frightened that Mama might guess her guilty secret, as she often did. But Mama looked at Gwenda.
"Who is your little friend?"
"Gwenda. I've brought her to see the puppies."
"That's lovely."
Mama suddenly looked tired. She closed her eyes and turned her head aside. The girls crept out quietly. Gwenda was looking shocked.
"What's wrong with her?" "A wasting disease."
Carus hated to talk about it. Her mother's illness gave her the unnerving feeling that nothing was certain. Anything could happen. There was no safety in the world. It was even more frightening than the fight they had witnessed in the forest. If she thought about what might happen, and the possibility that her mother might die, she suffered a panicky fluttering sensation in her chest that made her want to scream. The middle bedroom was used in summer by the Italians, wool buyers from Florence and Prato, who came to do business with Papa. Now it was empty. The puppies were in the back bedroom, which belonged to Carus and her sister, Alice. They were 7 weeks old, ready to leave their mother, who was growing impatient with them. Gwenda gave a sigh of joy and immediately got down on the floor with them. Carus picked up the smallest of the litter, a lively female, always going off on her own to explore the world.
"This is the one I'm going to keep," she said. "She's called Scrap."
Holding the little dog soothed her and helped her forget about the things that troubled her. The other four clambered all over Gwenda, sniffing her and chewing her dress. She picked up an ugly brown dog with a long muzzle and eyes set too close together.
"I like this one," she said.
The puppy curled up in her lap. Carus said,
"Would you like to keep him?"
Tears came to Gwenda's eyes.
"Could I?"
"We're allowed to give them away."
"Really?"
"Papa doesn't want any more dogs. If you like him, you can have him."
"Oh, yes,"
Gwenda said in a whisper.
"Yes, please."
"What will you name him?"
"Something that reminds me of Hop. Perhaps I'll call him Skip."
"That's a good name."
Skip had already gone to sleep in Gwenda's lap, Carus saw.
The two girls sat quietly with the dogs. Caris thought about the boys they had met, the little red-haired one with the golden brown eyes, and his tall, handsome younger brother. What had made her take them into the forest? It was not the first time she had yielded to a stupid impulse. It tended to happen when someone in authority ordered her not to do something. Her aunt Petronilla was a great rule-maker.
"Don't feed that cat. We'll never get rid of it. No ball games in the house. Stay away from that boy. His family are peasants."
Rules that constrained her behavior seemed to drive Caris crazy. But she had never done something this foolish. She felt shaky when she thought of it. Two men had died, but what might have happened was worse. The four children might have been killed too. She wondered what the fight had been about, and why the men-at-arms had been chasing the knight. Obviously it was not a simple robbery. They had spoken about a letter. But Merthin had said no more about that. Probably he had learned nothing further. It was just another of the mysteries of adult life.